Powered by volunteer community involvement, this is CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
My name is Olivia Norquaid. I'm Cinematech's programming coordinator and host of the horror film podcast and radio show Bikini Drive-In on CKUW 95.9 FM. We acknowledge that the Cinematech resides on Treaty 1 territory, the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and is the homeland of the Métis Nation, and we are privileged to be able to live, work, and play on this land. Bikini Drive-In's mission is to analyze horror and science fiction films through an intersectional feminist lens while combining elements of screen and media studies, arts criticism, and gender studies. Since we'll be discussing portrayals of horror and violence, content warning, listener discretion is advised, etc. Also, spoilers ahead. Today, I'm joined by Jill Greening. Hi, Jill. Thanks so much for being on the show again.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's so nice to be here.
Jill Greening is a dance artist and writer who holds a master's in theater and performance studies from York University. They have performed across Canada, specifically in Toronto, Vancouver, and Winnipeg, and their writing has been published by The Dance Current, the Journal of Curatorial Studies, and Dance International. They're curious about embodiment and like to explore methods of scoring and sensory-oriented documentation. Today, we'll be discussing Werner Herzog's 1979 film, Nosferatu the Vampire, which is available to rent from Cinematheque at Home until Friday, June 4th. If you're watching this on Facebook Live and have any questions, please feel free to leave them in the comments section and we'll try our best to answer all of them.
At midnight, all sorts of evil spirits are set loose. People disappear without a trace.
Last night, after a tiresome journey, I finally reached my destination, the castle of Count Dracula.
One sailor and our cook have disappeared without a trace.
Nosferatu, the Vampire, coming from 20th Century Fox. Nosferatu, the Vampire, a film unlike any Dracula film ever made. Nosferatu, the Vampire.
All right, shall I do the synopsis? All right. So it is 1850 in the beautiful, perfectly kept town of Wismar. Jonathan Harker, played by Bruno Ganz, is leaving on a long journey over the Carpathian Mountains to finalize real estate arrangements with a wealthy nobleman. His wife, Lucy, played by Isabella Gianni, begs him not to go and is troubled by a strong premonition of danger. Despite her warnings, Jonathan arrives 4 weeks later at a large, gloomy estate. Out of the mist appears a pale, wraith-like figure with deep sunken eyes who identifies himself as Count Dracula, played by Klaus Kinski. The events that transpire slowly convince Harker that he is in the presence of a vampire. Even still, he doesn't realize the magnitude of the danger he, his wife, and his town are about to experience. So Jill, what is your history with this film?
Good question. Yeah, it was so nice to rewatch this film. I was first introduced to Herzog in high school, which has resulted in him being like one of my favorite directors and I think one of my favorite personalities of our current time. Like even recently I saw him in an episode of like Parks and Rec. Like he's everywhere. It's amazing. But yeah, so I think my first Herzog film was My Best Fiend, which to see that, it like for that to be the introduction was very strange and destabilizing and kind of annoying, but it did get me to appreciate his like intensive theatrical and kind of like documentation focused methods of filmmaking. So my boyfriend at the time's brother was watching it, Riley Hill. Thank you so much for coming to me. And he was like laughing and having a great time and like in on the joke and in, you know, aware of what the film is. And I was just like, who is this like serious maniacal German man and what is going on? And that experience led me to watch like Strosek and Egwar and Fitzcarraldo and Kaspar Hauser and Wojcik all quite quickly. I think it was like a matter of weeks. I'd get off dance Friday nights at 10:30 p.m. and then like watch a Herzog film before like going back to the studio at 9 a.m. the next day.
Oh my gosh.
And yeah, and I remember seeing Herzog also in, he was acting in Julian Donkey Boy by Harmony Korine. I think it was released in 1999 alongside Chloe she's great. But anyway, yeah, so that like really sealed my fate. Like I got a sense of his humor and just like, oh, his voice. I just think he's so brilliant. So I hadn't seen this Nosferatu in years. So yes, having the chance to revisit it and think it kind of more through a critical lens was really, really fun. And yeah, I watched the 1922 Nosferatu, I don't know, every once in a while. So again, like to kind of have this version refreshed in my brain was really nice. What's your history with the film, Olivia?
Yeah, so this is my first time seeing Nosferatu, really. I'm not very familiar with Herzog's work, but I guess I kind of maybe unfortunately I associate his films with kind of like pretentious intro to film classes, which is like very funny because he's famously against film studies and any kind of like academic gatekeeping. But yeah, like you, I do find him to be a very fascinating cultural figure, and he just seems like someone like so serious but doesn't take himself very seriously. In interviews and in the My Best Fiend documentary, he seems quite warm and jovial, but his films are so miserable and epic. And we were talking like, the other night before for research for the show, and like, why does he have to make everything so difficult for himself? And like, why does every movie have to have a complicated raft? It's just like extreme Virgo energy. And like, yeah. Harmony Korine described Herzog's work as the cinema of obsession, which I thought was very apt.
Very apt. Yes. Yeah, everything is like, as you said, this epic feat. And then also the like the recursive qualities that they can have can be like overwhelming. Like in thinking of Fitzcarraldo, how it's this story involving moving, like a quest to move a boat over a mountain. Meanwhile, the real-time narrative is that also, and they're filming a documentary about this process called Burden of Truth. And yeah, and like his stubbornness, and he's so exacting, and the results of it are just like so fascinating. Mm-hmm. Absolute Virgo energy.
Yeah.
Coming from the most Virgo of all the Virgos that I know.
Yeah. But even I'm not even that ambitious. Like, that's crazy. So Nosferatu the Vampire is Werner Herzog's only horror film, kind of surprisingly. Are you a fan of his other work?
Yes. Yeah. He's iconic. And I do wonder, I mean, with, you know, working in performance studies, I do wonder how or in what ways his methods of filmmaking have influenced my relationship to theater and performance. Like so many of his films are done with scenes being in one take, which is like just bonkers. Yeah. And then they contain a sense of theatricality that like, it's so interesting through the film media, like it's this sense of like gaze within the form that's kind of like omnipresent. And it's so interesting when you're able to manipulate that, like you're able to rewind, you're able to pause, you're able to, as a viewer, play around with that. And then, but they also kind of contain this like temporal tension due to the actor's gestures and movements and impulses being free from edits. So it's fascinating. Like that scene, it's in My Best Fiend, but it's, I think it's in Wyzek from 1979, which is also a play by George Buchner. So it kind of, I guess, makes sense that it contains that energy. But it's Klaus Kinski and Eva Mattes, and they're in the kitchen, and it's this amazing long scene acted and shot in a way that's just like liquid. It's so beautiful. And yeah, his attention to landscape and location are also so interesting. And his use of like having few professional actors, but then also locals from wherever he's filming. There's like a sense of liveness and predictability that's like quite palpable. And then, yeah, I know we're all so sick of COVID, but I can't help but think of his work currently in relation to so many theater artists trying to figure out how to move forward when live venues obviously are still closed. And because he is able to bring this sense of liveness and presence that is being used by theater directors as they bring more works to screens and engage like digitally in that. And to speak of liveness and his methods too, it's so interesting and so intensive. So Virgo, that like for Nosferatu, he's filmed, he has it in German and he has it in English. And I love being able to see scenes and see how Kinski and Etjani gesture and move differently, like when in viewing scenes in both languages and how it acted there. Like, yeah, like the German version compared to the English version.
That's interesting. Yeah, I've only seen the English version. So it would be interesting to like compare, yeah, sort of like micro moments like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like you mentioned, the dialogue especially is like so theatrical and like theaterly, and maybe that's why I have a hard time connecting to Herzog's work. His films just have like this very wooden, unreal quality, if that makes sense. And like, I'm not a fan of theater. I find it somehow like too sincere and too artificial in a way that I find deeply embarrassing. But thinking about the theatrical acting and dialogue in contrast to Herzog's imposing landscapes, and it just feels like the unnatural and the hypernatural elements are at odds with each other throughout this film, especially.
I hear that. I hear you. I just instantly am thinking of, there's so much bad theater, as there is so much bad, there's just so much bad content out there in general and in all forms. And I'm just thinking of that, of the one play that we went to together and decided to leave it.
We had to leave. I think that was the last play I went to.
It was hot garbage. Yeah. Thanks for doing that. That was fun. That was a fun adventure. But yeah, so part of me's like, you just haven't seen the right theater things, but that's okay. And I, because you also have said that you don't like poetry. So I'm like, how are we?
It's too sincere. I don't like it.
I know, I need to make a little homework package for you.
Yeah, send me some readings.
exactly. But so many of the landscapes, I'm glad you brought up the landscapes, because yeah, so many are like quite violent and brutal and show elements of how nature is like active and volatile and destructive. Mm-hmm. And I think I inherently kind of think of the films like shot in the Peruvian wilderness, but even Nosferatu, like when Harker is venturing up to the castle, and I have it in my brain that the castle is discussed in the context of like being near a volcano, but I don't know if that's actually the case. I'm sure someone in comments will correct me, because I'm sure I'm wrong. But anyway, so he's like crawling over these rocks and witnessing these vast waterfalls. And I feel as though Herzog is like commenting on the unruly brutality of this mortal coil and like this bleak grandness of how the actors are engaging with their surroundings. And it's kind of like a tenderness that I feel. There's also that moment in My Best Fiend where Kinski has this idea that he wants the scene there, in like Machu Picchu area, and there Kinski's wanting the scene to be like on his face and about his acting or whatever, and Herzog is wanting it to be where it's like a stream of people just like making their way down the mountain, and there's like fog on one side. It's like so beautiful, but the fact that Kinski like got upset or like envious of this landscape, because that's the focus and not the human emoting, is just like, it's so interesting.
Such a weird partnership. We'll get into it a little bit later. He's able to portray bleakness and dread in really interesting ways using landscapes. And unfortunately, the landscape scenes in Nosferatu remind me a lot of Roman Polanski's Macbeth, where the landscapes feel very vast and foreboding and ancient, and of course, very damp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dampness. Dampness. It's a theme. Yeah. There's Cave of Forgotten Dreams from 2010, which is Herzog's documentary about the Chauvet Cave in southern France, and it contains some of the world's oldest cave paintings. It's a really great documentary. But I feel as though in there he discusses more how he perceives and depicts that like human environment relationship. So that's mm-hmm. like, if people are wanting more, I feel like he articulates some of it there. And then also in Grizzly Man mm-hmm. from 2005, he's like literally working with the stuff, like the meat of human and non-human, or in this case, bear relations, and how contested those relationships can be. And then in thinking of the context of Nosferatu, like human and non-human, human and other, human and plague or virus, like there's a sense of perpetuity that's in these like difficult and contentious or ambiguous relationships that's oddly comforting. His work, or I don't know if it's comforting or if it's more that they're just constant, which then it's like, well, at what point does like this constant become comforting? Like, what are the borders there?
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. On that note, we can talk a little bit about New German Cinema. So I have a quote here from filminquiry.com from an essay titled The Beginner's Guide to New German Cinema by Lee Jutton. So they write, in 1962, a group of young German filmmakers issued the Oberhausen Manifesto, which infamously declared the old cinema is dead. We believe in the new cinema. The new cinema would exist outside the existing German film industry, which was deemed too commercial by these rising artists and operate on incredibly low budgets. The new cinema would reflect the radical politics of the new generation of Germans, politics that often sympathize more with the socialist regime in the East than the capitalist regime in the West. The new cinema would be critical of the West German bourgeois democracy and its discriminatory treatment of those who fell outside of traditional social norms, despite repeated claims that Nazi dogma was a thing of the past. For all these reasons, the new cinema would be controversial and would struggle at the domestic box office despite growing acclaim abroad. These films, heavily influenced by French New Wave and unafraid of taking risks, would be known as new German cinema. So these films feature reoccurring themes of the rejection of the typical bourgeois lifestyle, alienation and loneliness. And some examples of the genre are Ali, Fear Eats the Soul by Werner Fassbinder from 1974, the American Friend by Wim Wenders from 1977, and All Around Reduced Personality by Helke Sander from 1978. And of course, Herzog's early work. Are you familiar with this genre?
I'm not familiar. No, I did some Wikipedia-ing and research, very superficial research about this genre. And yeah, I feel like because I really love Herzog's early work. Mm-hmm. And then also discovering like, Paris, Texas by Wim Wenders kind of is apparently categorized as new cinema. And I love that film. So I am curious about like what about this, like if there are style-based or aesthetic-based kind of like foundations with it. I do know, like I did find it interesting learning about how it is like the East German kind of reaction against what was happening in the West. Mm-hmm. But yeah, apart from that kind of more social political context, I really don't know. Mm-hmm. Well, tell us in the comments.
Yeah, sound off in the comments. Tell us about New German Cinema.
Yes.
So something I'm a little bit more familiar with is vampires and Dracula in film. So I have another quote from bloodydisgusting.com from an essay by Megan Navarro called Blood is Life, A Brief History of Vampires in Film. Bram Stoker's Dracula wasn't the first written works on vampires, but became the backbone of vampire cinema. Even while auteurs, filmmakers, and writers have explored what it means to be a bloodsucker, Dracula is the permanent fixture that's always lurking in the background, no matter the trend. Vampires have been metaphors for addiction, for loneliness, for sexuality, and everything in between. From the embodiment of evil to romantic lovers, from monstrous creatures to elegant immortals, the versatility of the vampire makes it the granddaddy of all movie monsters. So I find it interesting that Herzog's Nosferatu in this film, Count Dracula is more of a symbol of loneliness, and where the hunger for blood is kind of replaced for a hunger for human connection. And the vampirism in this film is also connected to disease, to contagion, and the plague. And to further that sort of theme, it's the vampirism is also connected, or it's passed along to Jonathan Harker, similar to a disease. What do you make of Herzog's interpretation and characterization of the Dracula figure?
Good question. Yeah, it's really interesting to conceive of the Dracula figure when we are so inundated with, there's so many points of like cultural connection to this like very mutable kind of creature. The one of my little favorites is the 1974 Blood for Dracula. Mm-hmm. It's really prominent in my head right now. And that sees Udo Kier as like this beautiful, very horny, yet very fragile vampire. Like there's something about that take on it that I really love. Mm-hmm. So there's that going on in my head. And then there's also the annoying racket that is the post-Twilight era vampirism as like this like sexy pro-life narrative, or like it's basically like a feminist nightmare. That
yeah, it's very like puritanical.
Oh yes, that series gets me. I cannot stand those ones. But yeah, so that is like coming to the like forefront when I think of, you know, Dracula and vampirism. And mm-hmm. I've also been reading Jack Halberstam's essay "Technologies of Monstrosity," Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Lend me that book.
Yes, it's so good. And I feel like now I just like always talk about Halberstam on this podcast. Yeah. Like almost every time it come up. Yeah, so this is, it's Skin Shows, Gothic Horror and the Technology of Monsters, published in 1995. I think it was their first book too, which is like, anyway, so I'm really intrigued by Herzog's reinterpretation of the original Gothic text. I know that there had initially been some copyright stuff going on with the Stoker estate, but it ceased, or I think like Stoker's widow passed or something, in order for Herzog to be able to make an homage to the 1922 German classic while incorporating like names that have been canonized by Stoker. So there are a few things I want to talk about with Halberstam's essay being like more like literary form or like language based, and then also immigration and fear of the other. Mm-hmm. And actually, interestingly enough, a lot of that kind of incorporates this idea of the porous or mutable boundary. So something that Dracula does very well, obviously, with like shape-shifting and with the sun sensitivity and movement across land, that those sorts of themes were kind of coming up a lot and are pervasive with all of this work. But something that's really brought up off the hop by Halberstam is the location of Transylvania etymologically. Like trans being across and Sylvania being the woods. So it suggests Dracula containing an identity that is like a boundary or a skin or a border. Like he's the one who crosses and the one who knows the other side. He's a composite of otherness manifesting as the horror essential to dark, foreign and perverse bodies. But yeah, and how the vampire is shaped through the original text. I remember when I was a kid reading like a junior version of Dracula, I probably maybe even had pictures. But I was really chilled by the fact that Dracula is always this distant figure in the narrative. Mm-hmm. Stoker's text is constructed through letters and anecdotes, all of this documentation that kind of floats around Dracula, like the monster never speaks directly to the reader. And then I was also thinking, I feel like that might actually occur in Frankenstein too, the monster always being on this periphery, in the periphery space, which just makes them more othered in a way. Mm-hmm. So Dracula's existence is always known through this degree of translation or separation. And this distance allows the vampire to have a certain like mist or cloud-like quality, which is present in a way that's really pervasive and dispersed and insidious and like almost like virus-like. Mm-hmm. So while this mechanism is obviously very generative as a reader in the film, this misty omnipresent quality is manufactured through the use of rumor and gossip, through shadow and through, there's like some dreamlike images of a flying bat. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that there's more, those are just the ones that came to mind. Mm-hmm. So our first possible encounter with Nosferatu is that image of the flying bat. And I think it actually might be how the film starts. I might be wrong. Yeah. And in my memory too, the bat is lit. And how the bat is lit, the viewer is able to see specks of dust in the air as the bat beats its wings. And there is this like texture of yeah. Ooh, I can't remember it. But there's like a that sense of dispersion, which is really beautiful.
Yeah.
And then when Jonathan Harker is traveling to visit Count Orlok's castle, the owner of the inn warns him about some scary business encountered by what appear to be a group of Roma people who are also inhabiting the inn. Mm-hmm. And this also seems to be a hint at the nationalist and economic anxiety towards people or groups of people who don't adhere to colonially sanctioned borders, mm-hmm. as Count Orlok is also known to do. But yeah, shadow is also obviously one of the creepiest methods of alluding to the Count's slippery methods of moving through space. So there's like that iconic scene of his shadow creeping up the stairs, which we see in the 1922 version, and Herzog very beautifully recreates. Mm-hmm. And then there's also, oh my gosh, one of my favorite scenes is when he creeps into Lucy's bedroom. The viewer is situated behind Lucy and she's brushing her hair in the mirror. Mm-hmm. And we see the bedroom door open and we see the Count's shadow. And although the viewer and Lucy are unable to see the Count's reflection in the mirror, obviously he's a vampire, his presence is known through shadow, and he suddenly just like appears.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, it's such a beautiful scene.
Yeah, it's so well done. I really like that scene as well.
Yeah. And in Stoker's book, in Dracula, there's like this idea of the monster as a master kind of parasite, and he feeds upon English wealth and health. So an element to that xenophobia that constructed the Dracula character is the idea of like the wanderer or the stranger in a strange land. Way of the Count, because his existence really reflects the way that homelessness or rootlessness can be seen to undermine nation. Mm. So the Count's ability to move freely between home spaces and to sneak onto that rickety boat and like kill the whole crew and then drifting into town really illustrates his ability to be clandestinely mobile. Mm. And I love that scene so much, where with that seemingly empty boat, there's no crew members except there's the deceased man who's I think like roped up to the elm or whatever, and the boat is just filled with rats and it just drifts along the canal and like bumps into the wharf. It's
It's so sinister and really great.
It's so good. And Werner Herzog is no doubt cognizant of like the really brutal stereotypes that form the foundation of the Gothic vampire, as with so many Gothic monsters, they come from some pretty hateful places. But his recreation might be more in line with like an outsider's ability to bring change to systemic or structural cultural paradigms, like as he said about Nosferatu, Nosferatu is not a monster but an ambivalent, masterful force of change. When the plague threatens, people throw their property into the streets. They discard their bourgeois trappings. A reevaluation of life and its meaning takes place. Mm. So in thinking of our listing off of what vampires or vampirism symbolizes or represents, whether it be addiction or loneliness or whatever, I do find it quite generative for Herzog to use the narrative as he says, a parable about the fragility of order in a staid bourgeois town. So Herzog also works against the vampire as a parasitic creature feeding off of English, or in this case, German wealth and health, by having the vampire bring about this like absolute destruction. Like he's not sneakily storing away gold. He literally obliterates the entire way of life in this town, providing a comment on like the thin film which conceals or contains high moralistic groundings. And the end of Herzog's Nosferatu, featuring that bizarre Last Supper, where the villagers are feasting among, there's like hordes of rats and abandoned belongings, and it's this chaotic upheaval, is like so good. And then there's also that scene that might best demonstrate Herzog's parable of the fragility of order in an uptight, dusty town, is the dialogue that happens between two village men as they try to figure out what to do with Van Helsing, who's being charged with the death of Nosferatu. And it's this really comical back and forth where these two men are at a complete loss with what to do with this apparent criminal. Like there's no police force and there's no guards to watch over the jail. Everyone has died because of this plague. And just their banter is so humorous, and this like really satisfying insight into the ridiculous like penal measures that our society has bracketed as just or valid. It's so such a perfect little
I was really surprised by the humor at the end of it, it kind of just falls into this like, or becomes this like comedy of errors almost. But yeah, between these two men that are like bickering. And then when like Jonathan Harker like scoots past the crumbled up crackers and like giggles, it's very silly. It's very funny.
It's so silly. It's so silly. And it's just like, oh, his sense of humor is like.
Yeah. A guy. Yeah. So what do you think of Klaus Kinski's performance? And I kind of see this as maybe the most accurate portrayal of Kinski himself, just kind of this like pathetic, violent, repulsive man.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's like such a loaded question. I mean, like he's an abusive man who is mentally unwell and has hurt so many people around him. Mm-hmm. And I think it's apt, like his embodiments of this lonely monster is, it almost like, yeah, there's a chillingness to it. Mm-hmm. Like that scene where after Jonathan Harker cuts his finger and Nosferatu is coming for him and he like swipes his chair out of the way and moves with this really calculated and sharp speed. And it's so terrifying. Mm-hmm. And then likewise, when he's approaching Lucy in the end and sucks her blood, like it's so revolting.
Yeah.
And so incredibly impactful. And I do recommend like watching Kinski, anyone who is watching Kinski act or whatever, like to watch My Best Fiend, because it does, it, there's some context that it does put his being into. But it's also interesting to think, yeah, like many of the roles, he's been in five Herzog films. Mm-hmm. And he's always playing a maniacal villain or like a colonizer of zero self-awareness for the people around him.
Absolutely. And
so I think that Herzog's motivation or intention to make that film, I think, is like, because it does put Kinski in a context. And I know that we'll talk later about like the glorification of abusive artists. And I do think that it helps to kind of be like, no, it was not good working with him, and kind of gets to the more complicated stuff rather than just like glorifying this guy.
Totally. Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the way that vampirism is portrayed, where it's kind of seen as like connected to loneliness and contagion and disease? Because usually it's like kind of like portrayed as being like very enticing and very sexy.
Yes. Yeah. Vampires are so often the horniest of the monsters.
Of course. They're great. And this film is just like so deeply unsexy to me.
Yes. Yeah. I agree with you. In many ways. Yes. Halberstam writes on the vampire itself as representing like the productions of sexuality. Mm-hmm. And then I do think that Herzog really generatively like messes this around by having the vampire bring about plague and kill. Like the method of death by plague is like not like a pale fainting into the grave. It's like so disgusting and brutal. It's so gruesome. And then also rather than being like procreative in any manner, which is still there, because I know you, like with Harker.
Yeah.
But the mass killing is like really vibrant for me. Mm-hmm. So, and I do think like vampires reproducing, however they might be gendered, I do think might be like one of the facets that incur this idea of like sexuality and erotica. Also with many vampires containing the option to kill or to turn their victims. So this like space that this allows for, like this decision is like very charged and like very sexy.
Yeah.
Like I'm reading a book on haptics and erotics by Laura Marx right now, titled Touch, Sensuous Theory and Multisensory Media.
Oh, la la.
But they write about how like what makes something erotic is the ability to oscillate between near and far and between control and relinquishing. Mm-hmm. And they discuss how what is erotic is being able to become an object with and for the world and to return to being a subject in the world, to be able to trust someone or something to take you through this process and to be trusted to do the same for others. So as much as I hate that I have this association in my brain that is screaming like Twilight, but like But there is that like really interesting thing of like, will you or won't you consume me? And like, will you hurt me? Will you
restrain? Yeah, there's that tension.
Yeah, that tension. And Herzog does delve into this in a little bit. In the scene of Lucy's death, Ajani has a really nice quote about it. She says, there's a sexual element. She is gradually attracted towards Nosferatu. She feels a fascination, as we all would think. First, she hopes to save the people of the town by sacrificing herself. But then there is a moment of transition. There is a scene when he isn't sucking her blood, sucking and sucking like an animal. And suddenly her face takes on a new expression, a sexual one, and she will not let him go away anymore. There's a desire that has been born. A moment like this has never been seen in a vampire picture. So I love that this moment happens. I really love her articulation of it. I feel as though a lot of the eroticism in Herzog's version almost appears kind of in this like cultural afterglow. As a viewer, we're so highly attuned to the fact that vampire films are sexual or have these erotic undertones. But in Nosferatu, these moments of desire peak in two vivid moments for me. The first is when Nosferatu hits the chair away and with the finger. And that precision that he moves with is so charged and yearning, but it's like so violent. So that's a moment when Nosferatu, as this lonely creature, is really kind of absconded, and a creature with very specific chaotic intentions is kind of scurries forth. So that moment really like kind of changes that moment or the like his character for me. And then the second moment is Lucy's death, which is so fascinating and made more fascinating in how Lucy's intentions change. Like how it starts off as this selfless sacrifice, and then there is like, it's captured that moment of desire and urge. Even then for her as an actor to be experiencing that change is just like, it's so amazing. And then with Parker, how Nosferatu is almost like he's the sexual predator in that way, preying on Parker. But in the context of Lucy, she's more that role. Like she's the one who's is in control and is like luring him.
I totally agree. And I'm so glad that you brought up that quote of hers, because her character does have more agency than I expected to. And she gets to sort of like play the detective in this role and wants to protect her town and her husband and is in control in that moment. Do you have a favorite on-screen vampire?
Good question. Chris Sarandon in Fright Night is like quintessential vampire one, I think. He's a cartoon vampire. It's very funny. And then as mentioned earlier, I love Udo Kier, Blood for Dracula. I also really like Tilda Swinton in Only Lovers Left Alive. I just love Tilda Swinton.
Yeah, I need to rewatch that, but I remember liking it. It is a tad slow, but I need to rewatch it. Because their portrayals of vampires are really cool. They're just like so sleepy and I just want to read books and cuddle.
And the soundtrack of that one's really nice too. That was the last film I watched at the Globe Cinema, I think. Oh. No, that was Francis Ha, never mind. But I did watch that one at the Globe, so I have fond memories of watching.
R.I.P. Globe Cinema.
Actually, no. That was a very uncomfortable viewing experience because the employee yelled at us when we tried to open our cans of wine. So
Whoops.
But still, beautiful theater. R.I.P. Yep. But yeah, I really like that one. And then I do think Count Orlok is just like so creepy. That's another one of my favorite. And I do have to mention off-screen vampire in books, publication, in media. I love Cassidy and Preacher. Reading Preacher, I'm feeling very nostalgic today. Reading Preacher on the number 11 bus at rush hour when the bus is like packed and you're reading this like graphic, very graphic novel. It's like one of my favorite Winnipeg memories. Matt Williams, if you're listening, watching, that was totally his copy.
Oh my gosh. I haven't heard of it. It's a graphic novel. Okay, cool.
Oh my gosh. I have Zach's old copies, I think. We can lend them to you. It's amazing. Yeah, Cassidy is this vampire character and he's charming. He's charismatic and sexy. So there we go. What about you? What ones stand up for you?
Yeah, I really like The Vampires and the Lost Boys and Near Dark. I just like these like hot young baddies who enjoy being vampires. And I think that like in the late 80s, portrayal is really refreshing and fun. Like they like being vampires, they get to commit some crime and they get to live forever. And I think that's great. I also really like Mr. Barlow from Salem's Lot, which also looks a lot like this Count Dracula and Sid Orlock. Like kind of is like bald and has like the spiky ears and like the two teeth. It's like, yeah, Salem's Lot, it's great. And of course, yeah, I love Buffy the Vampire Slayer and the horny music video that is Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula. Love that one.
That one is
it's so ridiculous. It's absurd, but I love it.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Something.
Interpretation.
Yes.
Just a loose interpretation of the text for sure.
Oh, it's so bonkers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in researching this film and vampire films in general, I came across an essay titled Not Just Dead But Gay, The Vampire as a Conduit of Culture Anxieties Concerning Queerness by William A. Tringali. And they write, the vampire is the queerest of monsters. Its terror does not emerge because it is an ungodly creation of science or a mindless killing machine. It does not rise from the deep, scaled and covered in algae to steal unworried beachgoers. It is not a mishmash of various corpses sewn together by a mad scientist. It does not howl at the moon or remain a mild-mannered jackal in its waking hours, only to transform when it lies down to bed. No, the horror of the vampire is sexual. Worse, it is sexual in all the wrong ways. It is beautiful, charming, even occasionally funny and likable, but definitely abnormal. This allows the vampire to become a conduit for cultural anxieties concerning queerness within society. As a creature that straddles between the binaries of life and death, drawing attraction and repulsion, the vampire queers both gender and sexuality. Stories about vampires can reflect and dramatize cultural anxieties surrounding queerness across both time periods and mediums. I think this also goes back to your idea of like the idea of borders and transcending various borders of like life and death, attraction, repulsion, even like geographically. That you mentioned. I also see more of a connection between Dracula and Jonathan Harker in this film, especially in the scene that you mentioned that Dracula enters Lucy's room. He seems almost jealous of their relationship and envious rather than wanting to pursue her. And I think he even states like, I want what you have, basically. So he's kind of this like, there's like, yeah, this idea of like longing and loneliness, but then he's also this like disruptive force that destroys their heteronormative relationship and also their village and their society. And like you mentioned, there's no cops, there's no politicians, there's no structure. He kind of breaks it all down. Yeah, what do you think of that reading?
Yeah, that's great. That's a great quote. Thank you for reading that. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I see that completely. It makes me really wonder about what Nosferatu desires, which is perhaps it's an effect of like having a vampire character that does like ignite kind of a pathos. Mm-hmm. Like, he does seem, there is that like kind of desire for human connection in a way, or like a human relationship or whatever. But like something more or different or distinct from his legacy, which is like massive cultural and systemic disruption and change. Mm-hmm. I agree that I think he could be read as a queer figure in the very nature that he disrupts these moralistic systems and in this case, his presence forces a re-examination of a way of life for the villagers. Mm-hmm. Like Nosferatu's presence disrupts, and it's unbound, it's multitudinous, and it's powerful. So yeah, I definitely think it's pretty apt to, I'm saying that word a lot today, apt.
Yeah.
to encode him or the being of Nosferatu as queer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like he represents a different way of living apart from capitalist enterprises, apart from nuclear families and societal norms. And Halberstam traces the history of gothic monsters, articulating how, well, monsters are often developed in response to class, race, or nation-based anxieties, which is something obviously you've talked a lot about on this show, but how the gothic era particularly saw sexuality becoming the dominant mark of otherness. So regarding their analytic angle, Halberstam writes that they're not wanting to simply attempt to add racial, national, or class difference to the already well-defined otherness of sexual perversion, nor are they attempting really another reading of the Gothic tradition, but suggesting that where the foreign and the sexual merge within monstrosity in Gothic, that there is a particular history of sexuality that unfolds. So it is indeed necessary to map out a relation between the monstrous sexuality of the foreigner and the foreign sexuality of the monster, because sexuality is itself a beast created in 19th century literature, is how they're approaching it. And where sexuality becomes an identity, others become invisible, and the multiple features of monstrosity seem to degenerate back into a primeval sexual slime. Class, race, and nation are subsumed, in other words, within the monstrous sexual body. Accordingly, Dracula's bite drains pleasure rather than capital. Mr. Hyde symbolizes repression rather than the production of self. And in both figures, there is a foreign aspect that is a threat to domestic security. So from this, the figure of Dracula, or Nosferatu in this case, like holds a lot of weight in how their being is like has been taken over with this otherness of sexuality. So like how sexuality has come to mark otherness in the 19th century and beyond is really quite exemplified in this narrative. And I feel like the quote you brought up too, then to kind of like takes it that like step further to discuss how this character is functioning in that way.
Yeah, totally. So this might be totally off, but the idea of sexuality and otherness and reproduction in vampire films led me down a rabbit hole of reading about the American singer, spokesperson, famous homophobe, and overall like vile human being, Anita Bryant. So I have a quote here. Anita Bryant became a controversial figure in 1977 when she successfully campaigned against a local ordinance in Dade County, Florida that prohibited discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. Under the slogan, "Save Our Children," Bryant perpetuated prejudices that associate homosexuality with child abuse. "The recruitment of our children is absolutely necessary for the survival and growth of homosexuality," she declared. "For since homosexuals cannot reproduce, they must recruit, must refresh in their ranks." Well, Bryant's Save Our Children crusade in Miami relaunched the religious rights involvement in politics. It also galvanized gay men and lesbians to become politically active and fight for equal rights. It was the beginning of two movements, the Christian Coalition and the gay rights. So I'm not too sure if Herzog was trying to portray any kind of critique of like homophobic panic with Nosferatu, but I think that with this sort of like Christian Coalition and these like right-wing homophobic ideals were definitely part of like the cultural consciousness, and I think of the time, and I think that like the themes of cultural and sexual insecurities within the new German cinema can also be connected to a queer reading of vampires.
I think that that's like a very valid and like interesting way of it, even like, because inherently, as Herzog's discussed with it, it is kind of touching on like societal upheaval and that
and that fear. It's just like fear of the other. Anyway, that quote is just like so repulsive and so infuriating.
Horrid. And then when like that kind of stuff is like still also prominent. Speaking of timely things, pressing timely things. I mean, it's interesting to be like discussing a film about monumental change, which is occurring following a plague in the film, and then currently in COVID.
In life,
And also, it was interesting, the mummies that are...
I feel like there's always like a little bit of question of ethics to every Herzog film. There's always like, can you film that, or why, what are you doing to that animal? Anyway,
the animal stuff, the
animal
is like,
stuff is like, ugh.
But yeah, those mummies were victims of an 1833 cholera epidemic, and they were, at least, I don't know if they still are, on display at a museum in Guanajuato, Mexico. Werner Herzog. Questionable thing for But yeah, like the optimist in me likes to kind of conceptualize this as a constant push for radical change, which we need to be seeing kind of throughout our current systems, and the possibility of this happening within pandemic landscapes is this it is interesting to be kind of thinking through this film in the time that we're at, just a little bit.
Yeah, and thinking back to the scene of all the people having a feast during, while bodies are burning in the square, and while a plague is happening, we just had an anti-mask rally in Winnipeg yesterday.
Yeah.
So there's just themes that are very pertinent to what's happening here now, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we have to take a kind of an uncomfortable turn and talk about Klaus Kinski's history of sexual, emotional, and physical abuse. So Paula Kinski, Kinski's eldest daughter, recently accused her father of sexually abusing her between the ages of 5 and 19. And I think it's important to bring it up. I also think it's really important to center her voice on the show. So I have a quote here from The Guardian. And this is Paula talking about her experiences. She recently wrote an autobiography where she talks about her whole childhood. So I've written a book about it because I can no longer bear the fact that a person whose halo gets bigger from year to year is being glorified in this way. She said she resented the fact that her father was increasingly hailed as an acting genius. That's why I wanted to create a very clear picture of who he really was, she said. She told the magazine that she had never been able to watch any of her father's films in which he typically played tyrants, criminals, and outlaws. When I did catch a glimpse of one, I always thought he's precisely like he is at home, she said. Whether people believe me or not, I was the one who experienced it, she continued. It is the truth. And yeah, I think it's very important to sort of talk, to center her voice and talk about her experiences, because Kinski is consistently praised as this gifted maniac, and I feel genius culture, whatever, within the arts allows people to get away with various forms of abuse and violence without any consequences because of their art. And it's just this combination of patriarchy, misogyny, white supremacy that shelters these so-called geniuses. And we still see this today with figures like Roman Polanski and Woody Allen, who are still making films and winning awards and getting book deals and shit. I don't know. It's it's very messy and very frustrating. But I think it's important to confront these subjects, especially if they make us uncomfortable, without glorifying the abusers. And I don't know, I still feel very squidgy about programming certain films or even discussing certain films on the show, especially if the abusers are still alive. I was nervous about programming Nosferatu because of Kinski. Mm. Yeah. I don't know. It's complicated. And I'm not entirely interested in separating art from the artist or whatever. That doesn't always feel very helpful to me. I don't know. What do you think? It's all very messy and I'm just spewing a bunch of ideas out, but
yeah. Yeah, no, I'm really glad that you brought his daughter's voice into this. I think that's really good. And yeah, because there's so much to say here. Yeah. I mean, I can't help but also in my own context, navigating abuse in performance context, mm-hmm. because people, it's just, that's the way it is, or, oh, but their work is good, or they have funding, or whatever. The fact that it's a breeding ground for these problematic practices. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the gifted maniac trope is so violent and it's so pervasive. And not to mention the fact that it really doesn't benefit anyone, mm-hmm. or the creators who are, or the abusers. I mean, granted, I'm also speaking in the context of making art when no one is making money.
Right.
There definitely are certain capitalist ramifications in that regard. Mm-hmm. But why that gifted maniac abuser thing, it just only perpetuates an idea that abuse is necessary to artistic production, which mm-hmm. is false. It's such mm-hmm. a fiction. And I really understand your hesitancy around certain programming decisions. It's so difficult to navigate.
Yeah. And I don't think there are any answers. Like you said, it's just kind of something to feel weird about, I guess. But it seems like, I don't know, on the film industry side, it maybe things are slowly changing where, I forget the name of this person, but it was like a huge producer was recently fired or forced to resign or whatever because of their like anger issues and like violent tantrums that they would have. But that's just like one guy and in the entire industry. So who knows? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, in these fields where there's like, where exceptionalism is so prominent and that kind of competitive atmosphere, like it does like breed that sort of.
So toxic. Gross.
Yep.
If anyone has any audience questions, if you're watching this on Facebook Live and have any questions, please feel free to leave them in the comments. We have one. Oh, first of all, Nosferatu the Vampire is available to rent from Cinematheque at Home until Friday, June 4th. FYI. So our first question is from David Knipe. Hi, David. More of an anecdote rather than a question. Have you two heard the story of Herzog hypnotizing his actors for Heart of Glass? Seems like that method would have been successful in Nosferatu, though I imagine it would be very difficult to sedate the madman Kinski. I had not heard that story, but I did hear anecdotes about for Nosferatu that Herzog would just like let Kinski have a tantrum and basically tire himself out like a child. And then they would film like the very quiet sort of sedate atmospheric scenes like once Kinski had when he was pooped and like what a strange relationship they had and like what a strange working relationship. Ugh. Deal with him like a child.
Thanks for that anecdote, David.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I've heard that it does lend a certain like creepiness, even if I don't know if it's a rumor, I can't remember. Mm-hmm. If it's whatever. Anyway, but it did that feel, yeah, like there's a sense of just this like eerie, like dissociative, like it's very strange.
I don't know. I don't know if we have any other questions, but I guess that's it for the discussion. Thank you so much for listening. You can listen to Bikini Drive-In every Sunday at 4 p.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. You can find me on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook page. It's all Bikini Drive-In. Jill, where can people find your work?
I have a website, but don't go there because it's really out of date. I shouldn't have even said that. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Jill Grading.
Great.
There, that's
perfect. It. thank you so much for Cinematheque for having us and letting us talk about the movie.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to see your face and so nice to get to talk.
Yeah. All right. Thanks so much, everybody. Bye.
Is the night of the vampire.
Powered by volunteer community involvement, this is CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.